Hello, I'm Mark Coles, and you join me climbing a ladder up into my loft for the final part of Media Futures, the series where the BBC has asked me to peer into my crystal ball to consider what might happen to our legacy media as the world becomes increasingly digital. Over the past 3 weeks, we've been looking at stories that illustrate the kind of changes going on in media around the world. Well, this week I'm going to be trying to work out what they all mean and the sort of broader lessons we can draw from them.
I think mobile is where everyone is headed. Everyone in every part of the media business is trying to figure out what the right approach is for mobile devices.
You have such deep knowledge about your audiences and what they do and the things that they're interested in, and that's power.
The challenge, of course, is for those who are operating commercially in this environment, how they wish to sustain businesses in this.
Of course, for people my age, today's media is totally different to how we remember it back in the pre-digital dark ages, or the early 1970s, as I prefer to call them. Over in this corner of the loft are all the albums I bought back then. This cut-price Jimi Hendrix compilation, one of my very first purchases. A record note made out of vinyl, not a CD or a download. The scratches give that away. Those were the days. Stereo had become all the rage. Some were even dabbling with quadraphonic sound. Then came hi-fi Dolby system, and in the 1980s, the arrival of the compact disc. But while technology changed, the manner in which recorded music was made and delivered stayed largely the same throughout. Musicians released their work through record labels. A finite number of discs were pressed, which we then had to go to buy at pre-established prices. In other words, there was a limited distribution of the medium, and in return, we were offered continual improvements in technical quality. Somewhere along the way, something changed. What we now want is unlimited distribution, just like the new MP3 music download affords. And we want it even if we have to sacrifice technical quality. And here begins our first wider lesson for the future of media.
I think quality also includes getting what you want when you want it.
That's Anthony Rose, the inventor of the iPlayer, which allows us to watch BBC TV programmes at any time over the internet. He has a nice anecdote about the emerging playoff between technical standards and increased access to the media.
One of our developers was telling me that he has a kid, a couple of years old, who began watching iPlayer on their Nintendo Wii, and it didn't work very well. The video would stop and the little buffering circles would come up, and when that happened, the child would start crying. But after a few weeks, the child actually stopped crying and took the buffering as an inevitable part of the video experience. And then one day they went to grandmother. Grandmother didn't have a Nintendo Wii, and so the child was unable to choose the program and to fast forward or rewind in the program and began crying. And so we need to redefine what is the experience we want from a beautiful high-def experience at a time that's predetermined to one that might be slightly lower resolution but is delivered when we want it.
And action. 2, 3, 4, 1.
We came across an example of this last week at YouTube, where videos aren't exactly big-budget Hollywood blockbusters, but are available at the click of a mouse or smartphone, completely free of charge.
3, 4, go!
In some cases, mainstream TV is now following suit. The US company Netflix recently chose to publish its premium House of Cards drama series all in one go, rather than the old-fashioned weekly episode-by-episode way. As Josh Benton of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard explains, easy access is the new quality.
In video in particular, there's so much more competition from cheaply produced episodic video or non-episodic video for whom quality means something different. Maybe quality doesn't mean it has the production values of Titanic, but maybe quality means it's actually about something that you're interested in. Or maybe it means that it can be produced in less than, you know, the 2 years or whatever it took to actually film, you know, a large movie. Speed and ease of use are real benefits. They are quality in a lot of ways.
And there's a corresponding phenomenon at play too. As we demand to watch, listen, and read at our own convenience, rather than that of middlemen publishers, we are becoming, in effect, curators of our own media world. The old idea of a newspaper, a TV channel, or a record label collating or aggregating every item of content for you no longer holds true. I spoke to David Campbell, a blogger and photojournalist who's written about the new media landscape, in order to find out more.
Music is a good example of this. What the download of digital tracks has done has kind of exploded the concept of the album for many people, because people don't have to buy the 13 songs the artist put together and said, here, you've got to get all 13. If you only like three, you go direct to a source to get those three tracks. So the album has been disaggregated.
But it hasn't killed the album off, has it? I went and bought David Bowie's new album the other day just because I was intrigued and I wanted to hear it all.
Absolutely. Digital downloads haven't killed off the album completely, but they've undoubtedly disaggregated it and they've undoubtedly challenged it as a dominant form.
It seems in future our media will be increasingly bite-sized, unconnected chunks available for us on our own terms, even if it's not always quite as technically sophisticated as it once was. If that's the first lesson of our media future, then what's the second? Time to phone a friend, I think. What do you think is the future for our legacy media like newspapers, radio and television?
Would you like me to search the web for the future for our legacy media like newspapers, radio and television?
Well, are you the future for our legacy media?
You're certainly entitled to that opinion.
Mobile phones like this trusty iPhone with its mouthy Siri virtual assistant already talk back to us, and they're about to start doing a whole lot more. As we heard in our programme about radio, the media future is a mobile future.
I think mobile is where everyone is headed. There's very little reason why desktops or laptops are going to be making a comeback as a share of people's attention.
Josh Benton again.
It's still easy to underestimate how important that shift is going to be. I'm not sure that it's quite at the same level of impact as the original arrival of the web, but it's not that far behind. It's a really important shift, and news organizations are not ready for it. We already see in the United States a fair number of large news sites where the majority of their web traffic is coming from phones and tablets, where the desktop and laptop web is a minority of their traffic at certain times.
The consequences of this mobile and tablet explosion do look significant for a number of reasons. One is that, as we heard in our program about newspapers, we might once again find the time to read news in depth the way we routinely used to do with the printed word. Another is that media will be more personalised, talking to us as individuals in a way that collectively consumed media like newspapers and TV stations can't. In our first three programmes, we heard how precocious all-knowing things called computer algorithms now loom large in the media future, crunching our browsing histories, following our every click and tailoring personal menus accordingly.
We call it the reverse search metaphor. Instead of you searching for content, we want content to find you. Your phone should know what you're looking for and serve it to you kind of proactively.
As we rely more and more on handheld devices, more and more of us, wittingly or unwittingly, are likely to subscribe to this model in the future. As a result, more media will be delivered this way, raising its own questions about media ethics and effectiveness. According to Neil Thurman of City University here in London, it's not just a question of algorithms finding personalised content. In future, they're going to be producing it too.
What we can see even today with algorithmic news are computers getting involved in news detection. So, for example, they look at what other content has been published. They look at the value of advertising. And then their algorithms suggest stories that, if written and published, would attract high-value advertising. Another example of algorithmic news would be where computers are actually writing news stories based on data feeds. And there's a company in Chicago who have developed this kind of algorithmic journalism, and they're selling these computer-generated stories to local newspapers, and these stories cover subjects ranging from sport to financial stories, even to local politics.
My feeling is that I would be skeptical about that as a major player in the future.
David Campbell.
I actually credit the audience, or as one journalism professor says, the people formerly known as the audience, because they have a much more active role now. I credit them with, you know, a considerable bit of intelligence about choosing the sorts of sources they like, and I think that people are going to be able to spot algorithmically produced material. People are pretty skeptical about those sorts of things, and they're not bad judges, actually, of the quality of information that they want.
So, the jury's out on that one. But what's not in doubt when it comes to mobile algorithmic media is that where our media was once dominated by newspaper barons and big TV chiefs, in future they're likely to be joined, perhaps even eclipsed, by the likes of Silicon Valley. And here lies our third big pointer for the future of media.
The industry has found itself to a large degree following the lead of technology companies that have become the experts and are not only creating the devices, but are creating the algorithms that bring people their news, that are getting the advertisements in this realm in a way that the news organizations haven't been able to do. And so there's a whole new kind of competition where the news industry is almost on a treadmill trying to keep up with all these changes that are happening.
That's Amy Mitchell of the Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C., who compiles a regular survey of trends in the U.S. news media.
There are a couple of different elements to the role and the influence of these technology companies. One is their vast knowledge and expertise in the area of technology just makes them a leader in and of itself. So absolutely they have a leg up there, just in terms of their expertise. The other is the audience data. And the issue of privacy and the privacy of my own data and what I do is one that's going to be a big part of the next 5-6 years. And whether you're Google or whether you're Facebook or whether you're Apple, you have such deep knowledge about your audiences and what they do and the things that they're interested in that the news organizations don't have. And that's power.
Then there's the question of what it's doing to us. The fact that media is being tailor-made to suit our busy lives and our preferences and increasingly consumed on personal mobile devices leads some to worry whether our future media will be as socially binding as we need it to be, or whether we'll all just exist in our own little bubbles, unconnected and unconcerned with the wider world. As Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg is quoted as saying, a squirrel dying in front of your house may be more relevant to your interests than people dying in Africa. But Josh Benton of the Nieman Journalism Lab thinks dire warnings about the dangers of individuation, of technology turning us into recluses, are well wide of the mark.
If you look at social media, an area of huge growth, the idea of someone seeing an interesting video, reading an interesting story, and then sharing it on Twitter or on Facebook, that's fundamentally a conversation-stoking social experience. And there's a really deep urge in all of us, I think, at a fundamental level, to want to share information. That sort of push towards conversation, I think, is deep in our DNA and a big part of how we've evolved as human beings. And that's not going to go away.
The way that people put together a lot of their social media streams, they have a very wide range of sources, friends and colleagues to be sure, but they go direct to other storytellers and other news producers. And I think that actually the breadth of those sources is at least as high and probably actually greater.
David Campbell again.
You know, there is a very common argument that in social media the age of serendipity is past and people no longer run into things that would surprise them or are unexpected as they did when they turned the page of a newspaper and encountered a story they weren't following or something. And I'm very dubious about that understanding.
David Campbell cites one recent example. Last year, a video highlighting the atrocities of Joseph Kony and his Lord's Resistance Army went viral on YouTube, scoring 56 million views in its first few days. The activities of a Ugandan warlord, hardly the kind of story to attract a teenage audience in Britain, he thought. But he was in for a surprise.
I was reading how it was circulating widely and was being spread through social media, and I was working at home doing this upstairs in my study, and it was the end of the day. I went down and my daughter had come home from school. She was in the front room and she was watching something on her iPhone, and you know, I was intrigued as to find out what the video was, and she says, oh, it's a story about a warlord. And so I realized that, you know, what I'd been following in terms of people already critiquing this on the networks that I used, it had already entered the house downstairs through her social media networks. And it was because her friends had come across it, posted it, circulated it, and she was paying attention to it. There are many lessons to learn in the way that thing spread around. And what was most striking, of course, is that when people followed friends' recommendations, they were prepared to sit and watch a 29-minute video on an international story. I think that's pretty significant in itself.
You sound very sanguine about the future. Serendipity is out there. The audience is being educated, getting a richer experience than before. I think the future all good?
I am quite sanguine about it in the sense that I think this is one of the best times in the media. If we're just looking at the content that's available and the richness of that content that's available and our capacity to put out stories and respond to those, this is a very good time. The challenge, of course, is for those who are operating commercially in this environment, how they wish to sustain businesses in this.
Ah, yes, the producers. It seems we, the content makers and broadcasters, might be the ones to pay the ultimate price for all the on-demand, personalised, interactive mobile media that you, the audience, seem to increasingly want. Over the last few weeks, we've been looking at how content providers are trying to monetise this new digital landscape and the way they hope they can learn to adapt to radical change. In the past, remember, the market favoured limited distribution, allowing distributors to set their price. Now, thanks to the internet, media has to find other ways of making a living. Once again, big technical companies will be the main beneficiaries. And the main victims, as we saw in our first programme, will be the print media, newspapers and magazines, whose advertising market has all but collapsed.
Future of advertising in India is still good. It's robust compared to the Western model, which was essentially revolving around classifieds and retail advertising. And if you appreciate that, classifieds were the first to move out to the internet because of the ease of use.
There are a few specific countries, India being the prime example, where newspapers are booming. In the developed country, in the United States, in Europe, and other places, newspapers are not in a very positive trajectory. Just to look at the United States, overall advertising revenues for print newspapers have gone from somewhere around $50 billion a year just, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, down to under $20 billion a year. The way that some newspapers have responded to that is by trying to go up market to try and reach a wealthier audience, but there's only so much movement you can make there.
The question is how much diminution has occurred in the level of reporting that these organizations are able to do as they've had to scale back their news operations.
Here's Amy Mitchell again.
A lot of what used to be structured around beat reporting, so you were the health reporter, you were the education reporter, you were the state government reporter, those pretty much got taken away. And everybody became a staff reporter for the most part and sort of jumped from one story to the next. And there's really sort of two different levels of effect there. And one is the kind of incremental story that emerges, whether it's this slow decline in the housing market that really didn't get noticed until suddenly, wham, bang, we're at, you know, disaster point here, because nobody's tracking that. It's not until some big event occurs that the news organization says, oh, hey, okay, reporter A, go cover this one. And then that reporter, when it comes time to cover it, doesn't have the deep resources to turn to be able to then offer that really deep level of reporting.
It's a scary future in some ways. Lots of things we've come to rely and depend upon over the years, newspapers, radio, television, curated content, cultural gatekeepers, authoritative, informed expertise, seem to be flying out of the window. And what's coming along in their place, microblogs, recommendation sites, social media and comment pages, seem built on not so firm or secure foundations. It feels like we're hurtling into an unknown future, putting our trust in technology, interactivity and shared experience while simultaneously watching everything that's gone before being dismantled, sorry, disaggregated in front of us. And maybe it doesn't have to be that way. Perhaps there is an alternative third way for parts of our beleaguered media. And again, it's music that provides a parallel.
To me, it's fascinating that in the music field, you know, we went through the CD and then we went to digital downloads and MP3s and so on. And yet at the same time, in terms of percentage, one of the other growth areas is vinyl. People want vinyl for the quality of sound, for the particular niche it occupies. And I do think that with the rise of digital, where everything is reproducible and everything is easily circulated, when you have the capacity to copy everything, being able to own and access some things that can't be copied, that are particularly unique, also becomes attractive. So vinyl is kind of, quote, returned for a particular niche in music, but it won't be the mass distribution platform it once was.
But isn't part of that shift to vinyl reaction against new technology? People are just getting sick and tired of the amount of stuff out there.
No, I don't see it as a reaction. I see it as kind of itself actually a new development, even though it's an older platform and an older technology. Because it's not that people suddenly get sick and tired and think, oh, God, you know, I wish I wasn't able to download all that music instantly onto my iPod. We're not going to see suddenly all the hundreds of millions of users of iTunes for digital downloads suddenly saying, you know what, going to give that up. Actually, really just want to go back to the record store. That's not going to happen.
Shame.
Well, it's a shame for record store owners, yes.
It seems ironic that I'm ending this series about the future of media, sat in my loft surrounded by things from my distant past, talking about the return of vinyl. But then, as we just heard, what goes round comes around, which is a comforting thought in times of radical change. Except this time, I get the distinct feeling it's different. Something massive is underway. The internet, new technology, mobile and digital distribution models have all pulled the rug from under the feet of the established order, our old-style newspapers, television and radio. I started these programmes slightly cynical, you may have noticed, a little reluctant and unsure about the media emperor's brand new clothes. But from the US to India, Africa and Europe, I've learned a lot along the way, come to recognise and understand the scale of change, even embrace it occasionally. There's no point yelling that barbarians are at the gates, brandishing their bite-sized chunks, second screens and poor quality MP3s. They're already here. The future is now, and we're right in the midst of it. I might just have to clear some more space up here. A radical thought, but before long, newspapers, fixed schedule TV, the box in the corner, the old radio set, may just be heading up to join all the other junk in the attic.